be mindful of how you're entering your station, how you're entering your home. Drop your uniforms in the bay and run in naked into the station and shower so you don't track all that stuff in.
Today we have the pleasure of visiting with Dawn Bolstead Johnson. She is the author of a brilliant little book called Exposed: Carcinogenic Exposure on the Fireground and 11 Work Practices to Minimize the Risk. She tells us all about this book and the 20 years of experience she's had researching and considering the carcinogens and exposures that we face on and off the fireground, around the firehouse, etc. Let's give it a listen and take heed to what she has to say. Check it out. Welcome to the Fireground Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Rain Gray. Here, we're going to talk about all things pertaining to life on and off the fireground. The opinions expressed are mine and those of the guest. So, let's get started.
So that's when I learned about industrial hygiene when I was at U of A. I was pre-med up until then and took a lot of science and physics and chemistry. When I learned about the field of industrial hygiene, the way it was explained to me is that if you're a doctor, you're taking people out of the river that already have the disease or already have the broken leg, and you're treating the symptom or you're treating the disease, and the industrial hygienist is upstream trying to prevent the exposure that causes the disease. And so then I was hooked, and I changed my career, my academic career, and right. Started studying industrial hygiene. And then I started working for an industrial hygiene consultant firm and did a lot of work in asbestos and worked in New York City quite a bit doing asbestos investigations. I was a New York City asbestos investigator and got tired of doing asbestos and saw the job with the city of Phoenix, and I thought it was my path to get away from asbestos, but they actually hired me because of my experience in asbestos.
Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting how that feeds, mm-hmm. As much as you hated it, it actually, it buttered your bread. That's awesome.
So then I came to work for Phoenix, and I was in the personnel department in the safety section. There was three industrial hygienists, and we would go do all the departments. So police, fire, public works, library, water, parks. I mean, you name it, we were kind of the consultants for the whole city.
Oh, cool.
And so by then I had already learned that I didn't know a lot and there was a lot more to learn, so I decided to go back and get my master's degree in public health back to U of A. But I had a commute to Tucson and to do that, and so I saved up vacation time and did it while I was working, and then it came time for my thesis. And as part of your thesis, it didn't have to be the same thing, but I had to do, as part of my academic requirement, I had to do an internship. And the internship, so I was already a certified industrial hygienist. I was already working as an industrial hygienist for probably close to 10 years, and I didn't need to go do an entry-level thing. And so I had asked Chief Storman at the time, I had heard that fire was using carbon monoxide meters as an indicator of when it was safe to take their SCBA off after a fire. And I said, how did you come up with that? How do you know when CO is low, everything else is low too? And he basically said, I don't know, that's just the way we've always done it. So I proposed to do a study on fire.
Which is a famous quote in the fire service, because I think every fire chief has uttered those words, right? And every firefighter has ever uttered those words. You know, we always reflect on our tradition, unimpeded by progress.
Right. So anyway, I proposed to do an overhaul study as to satisfy my internship. And I had a self-serving reason to do it because I could knock out.
Right.
I had to do the equivalent of 6 weeks of work, which is like 240 hours. And so I thought, I can knock out 24 hours at a time just by spending the night at the station for this study. So I had a self-serving reason to do it. It turned into something much bigger than I ever imagined it would.
Right.
But at the time, I was just looking to knock out those hours without killing, because I couldn't use my current job as my internship. I had to have something that wasn't part of my normal duties.
Yeah.
So
you got to add academic rigor somehow.
Yeah.
So we're going to stress you out and load you up with
Yeah, extra, extra.
So the study was, the initial overhaul study we did, like, I can't even believe it's been over 20 years ago. We did that in 98.
Wow.
And so they set me up with a hazmat team, and I trained 12 hazmat technicians to be my ears and eyes and legs and arms and
data collectors.
Yeah, the data collectors. And so they would, they were trained in how to run all the equipment, and then they would help gather all the equipment after the monitoring event and package the samples, and then I would get paged and either meet them at the scene or meet them back at Station 4 to help package everything up, because I just couldn't be there, you know, for 3 months straight doing all of it. So when we first started training, I had like a 4-hour training session to kind of go over everything, and it was marrying these two worlds of industrial hygiene and hazmat, and you think they're kind of in the same ballpark, but they're really not, because industrial hygiene is, they explained it to me like a bull in a china shop. You know, industrial hygiene is very precise, and we're hanging meters and we're looking at serial numbers on pumps and calibrating flow rates and putting the media in. And so when I was going over all the instructions with them and said, it's really important you write down the serial number and really important you do this. And one of the guys came up with a color coding system. He goes, we're not into all this detail. Can't you just have a green pack, a yellow pack, a blue pack, and a red pack? And then it's the blue formaldehyde meter and whatever that serial number is. And I was like, okay, that's marrying those two worlds was, because I would have never come up with that on my own.
Right.
And so that was pretty cool. And so after I trained the first set of four, then they came back to the second session, and then by the third session I had all 12 of them, because they just, it was kind of overwhelming, the whole thing was. And I mean, to this day, I think back and just like, I don't know how we pulled it off, but we got over 26 samples, 26 independent fires monitored, and 26 monitoring events, I should say. And at those monitoring events, we had over 100 data points at each one. So.
Wow. And so what was the big takeaway from that study?
That CO doesn't predict the presence of anything else, presence or absence of anything. So CO is not an indicator gas for anything else that could be at the fire scene.
All right. Do you happen to know if in the last years, early in my career, I remember seeing, you know, we would monitor after fires, and that was something that was still going on early on in my career. And I haven't seen any type of monitoring in the last, you know, I don't know how many years it's been, but the last grip of years. And so across the American Fire Service, is that something that is being done at all, any type of monitoring or data gathering for the purposes of overhaul or things like that? Or do we just know, like, hey, we can't capture all this information, it doesn't do us any good, we just have to protect ourselves, and that's
they're still using CO as an indicator gas across the country, and it makes me sad, you know, because it's people are trying to monitor because they recognize there's a hazard, but the information, and that was kind of my motivation for writing the book. I go to an industrial hygiene conference every year and talk to the manufacturers that are selling the four gas meters and everything.
Right.
And they're telling me they're selling 20,000 CO sensors a month to fire departments across the country. And so they're not motivated to change that practice.
For sure. Right. Well, yeah, the market demands, right?
Yeah.
So this book, Exposed, is 20 years in the making, essentially, because from the starting point of your research, monitoring CO, and for, you know, for a good reason, obviously, the opening of your book, one of the first things that you bring up is the incidents with the CO monitoring. You talk about that right away. The conversation that's happening in the American Fire Service is everyone's beginning to recognize, right? There's a statistic, I believe it's 67% of line of duty deaths are related to cancer. And so we're beginning to realize in the last few years that things are changing in the American Fire Service. These rates of exposure, we talk about fire dynamics and fire behavior. That's changed. And why is that changing? Well, because the contents of house fires is changing. And so because of that, the nature of the hazard is evolving as well. So everything that we're looking at is beginning to change the fire service. So the reason I wanted to sit down with you is because this book really lines out some things that we can do and really lines out the nature of our exposure. And if I can, if I remember what page it's on, I think I found it. It was page 14. You have a chart of toxic chemicals that are identified. And I counted it up, and if my math was right, it's like 29 toxic chemicals that are present at every house fire that are largely invisible. And so, yeah, we can monitor for CO, but what does that really do for us? And the answer is absolutely nothing, which is what you point out here.
And just to kind of dovetail onto that comment, I think this is underreported. So I think there's probably way more than 29 things. We just didn't have the budget to sample for everything.
Well, so that brings me to another question I have, which is what other types of studying or research is being done now that we've kind of cracked the can open and we go, okay, we know that this is much more dangerous than it previously was in, yesteryear, if you will. So what kind of research is being done that you're hearing about or that you know about or that you're involved with?
Well, I've been reviewing some papers that are about to get published, and one of the things that just came out recently was training burns and the fuel used in training burns. Mm-hmm. And as I was reviewing the paper, the authors were talking about how much more toxic the oriented strand board fuel source was than pallets or wool or hay or straw or all the different things they use in training.
So what we call the Class A, there's variants in that, right? We talk about what's in the OSB.
Well, there's a lot of formaldehyde in that. And so as that OSB heats up, it's all glued together, high pressure wood chips and glue. That's basically what OSB is.
Right.
And
so what's in the glue is the question,
it's
right?
It's the aldehydes. And so the researchers found high levels of aldehydes in those environments that were just training burns. And so no plastics, no anything else. And I was able to sway the author to change the title of the article to identify that, hey, pay attention to what you're using in your training burns, because now you're exposing your people to toxics in training that you don't really need to expose them to.
Right. Yeah, it's bad enough we're getting it on the emergency house fire, right? That emergent event where you're exposing yourself, but now we're voluntarily exposing ourselves in training fires.
And I think training instructors have a much higher exposure just being inside with the cycles as the guys are going through, the guys and gals are going through their training events.
The repetitive exposure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just, a couple episodes ago talked to Bill Reaney, and Bill Reaney was a fire starter assigned down there while he was going through chemo. And, but this was 20 years ago, and we didn't know what we didn't know. So, or we barely knew. We were beginning to know, I guess I could say. But we didn't understand some of those deep exposures. And it's good that we're beginning to reveal that stuff and peel it back. So there's some research you talk about in here, which I think is really fascinating. So you talked about, there's the story you share with Andy, the engineer. So there's a couple different things. And you talk about the study you guys did with breast milk, which I know for a large percentage of my audience is going to be like, who cares about breast milk? But for my sisters out there, this is a really important thing to consider as you go through your life and begin to have kiddos, et cetera, and what kind of exposure are you taking on? Tell me a little bit about that study.
Well, I was working as an industrial hygienist for the Phoenix Fire Department, and a female firefighter came up to me and asked, she told me her story. She was found out she was pregnant. She was put on light duty immediately, taken out of the field, so no exposures during her pregnancy. She went on maternity leave, had a healthy baby, elected to breastfeed her baby, which a lot of moms do because you're trying to give your baby the best. And she came back to work her first shift, and she got a fire. And she said, when is it safe to feed my baby? And so she had already vetted out with La Leche League and all these breast milk, you know, communities that, you know, when moms are having trouble getting breast milk to come in, or the volume is too much, or the volume is too small, or all the issues that you have with breastfeeding, and nobody had any data on exposures. Yeah. And I'd like to point out, too, that even though your audience may not consist of a lot of female firefighters, the men should pay attention to the study. And the reason is because every firefighter that has been to a good fire, and you can smell that fire for 3 days later.
Oh, yeah.
And I've heard guys say, tell me what's taken 3 days to get out of my body. And the breast milk is a way to capture that. So whatever comes out of the breast milk study is probably the fat-soluble chemicals that you're exposed to that are absorbing into your skin, or you're inhaling and getting into your body that way. And it's so everything goes in the breast milk.
Yeah.
So if mom eats chocolate bar and baby's allergic to chocolate, the baby has a reaction from the breast milk. And so whatever goes in the woman's body, it's the same blood stream, you know, throughout, so it's not separate compartments, and
right.
and they're exposed. So I think it's you know, even though guys might think I don't have an interest in that, they should, because I think that'll give them some answers that they've been looking for a long time.
Right. It's amazing to me, so that I feel like we can say her name. Nicole Minnick was the one who brought this forward. And, you know, I think about when my wife and I had kids, and I think about, you know, Nicole is a caring mom. And I think about, you know, all the different things that we worry about when we have a brand new baby. And the last thing that I ever thought about is exposing my kids. Like, that was never even on my radar as something that I was worried about. And to think, man, as a new mom, of the thousands of things you got to worry about, and on top of that, you got to think, man, am I exposing my child to something here that downrange could have some adverse effects? Especially if you're at a busy company, getting lots of fire, and that exposure is repeated. You know, there's a lot of detail in your book about how that study was conducted. So I would suggest that people pick up this book and read that, because the details of the study, like, talk about sacrificing, you know, having to pump breast milk and do all this stuff to capture data. Nicole was a diligent soldier for us on this, and so appreciate her. Is that studying continuing anywhere, or is it?
It is. It's been expanded. So this was a pilot study that U of A was nice enough to fund out of their back pocket. They didn't have any grant money for it, and I have a link in the book to the current study that's going on. They have over 20 participants, and they're just wrapping it up now, and they've got a lot of good data on it. But the general rule of thumb is, if you're breastfeeding, pump and dump for 3 days post-fire. It's the same amount of time that it takes that smell to go away. And you have to also think about your baby as, you know, or as toxicity, as dose makes the poison. And so when you're a 150-pound person, the dose is going to be higher than it is for a 12-pound baby. And so looking at it that way, too, I think there should be some thought into reconsidering taking babies' pictures on top of turnouts, too, for that same reason.
Yeah, that's a disturbing trend. You know, as I read your book and started thinking about that, and now every time I turn to Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and there's a picture of a kid, you know, sitting inside of a helmet or laying on top of someone's coat or whatever, I'm just like, oh, man, this is... I hope that stuff's clean. And even if it's clean, I'm not sure. And we'll talk about that in a minute, about how clean your cure really is. But yeah, that is a disturbing trend for sure. So not only let's just walk through your book here briefly, because I think that you offer these anecdotes up front, and you talk about some research, and then you go into some things that we can do. And you know, we think, I spent a few years, 5 to be specific, as an engineer. And when I read Andy Brunell's story about his cancer, and, you know, I thought, man, engineers are truly exposed. So I guess, what are some considerations as an engineer? You're out by the pump panel and, you know, there's times the smoke wafts over you, but then it changes direction or what have you. I've been on a couple, you know, large campaign fires where the smoke was persistently to the east and I had, like, I'm in the middle of it for hours at a time. So just put on my bottle and that was it. But I'm wondering, you know, my thought is how much more could I be doing as an engineer when I'm standing out by that pump panel?
I think it starts in training too. So you have to, you know, when I was talking to Andy interview, and it's funny how Andy's chapter even ended up in the book, because I was calling him as a friend, because I've known Andy for years, to get some pull quotes to try to make some of the quotes that are in the book, you know, just be poignant enough and strike an emotion or something with somebody. And so when he was telling me his story, I asked him if I could make it a chapter. So Andy reviewed this chapter multiple times before it went to print and approved it and everything. And I'm so happy that he shared his story with him, because I was like, oh my God, I had no idea the detail.
Yeah. The engineer, you know, we think about fire exposure as in I went into the fire. But that there's collateral impact that fire has. Mm-hmm. And that's, his story really illustrates that.
So the way Andy explained it to me is, like, in training, you're trained to get that truck as close as you can to the fire, so that your hose lay is, you know, you have enough hose to get to where you need to go. And
right.
But he explained if you could just park across the street and give yourself that extra 5 feet, yeah, buffer space, solution space, whatever you want to call it, that would be a benefit to the exposures to the engineer. But that's a whole complex thing to unwind.
Well, and the sometimes the fire ground dictates, mm-hmm, based on space and vehicles and traffic and
right,
access for other vehicles, et cetera.
And first on, but, and I mean, there's right, so many variables. Mm-hmm. But if you were to train to protect the engineer, you know, and I'm not saying that I have the answer, but it's something that should be discussed. And
right,
and there are solutions that could be simple, but
right,
simple, but not maybe easy to execute.
Right. Yeah, I found myself saying that a lot, actually. There's a lot of simple things that we could be doing. And I think with, and what's, when you, at the end of this, what we're going to realize is that there's a lot of steps you can take, a lot of little details that you have to take into consideration. And if you're doing all of those things, it gives you your best chance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
there's not one magic bullet.
Right. Yeah. So Andy talks about, you know, SCBA and PPE, et cetera. So what does, what is the benefit? Well, I guess the benefit is he's putting on PPE. You're protecting yourself from the skin exposure. You're preventing inhalation exposure. It's just it's a paradigm shift for the way we do business.
Well, and it's also, you have to think about, you know, other things too. If you're in full turnouts, you know, what about heat stress for the engineer? Because he's not there just for 20 minutes, you know, he's
right,
there for the long haul. So I think at the very least, some level of respiratory protection, if there could be an airline system where he could hook up and still move around. But like Andy described, his role to me is that he's sometimes running all over the place. He's at the pump panel, then he's getting kinks out of hoses, and then he's running to get ladders for people, and mm-hmm, and he's working that scene. He's not just stagnant
right,
at the panel.
Right.
So, but still, if you can be on air at any time, that would be some benefit, you know, more than being exposed the whole time. So I think it's just minimizing exposures, or and then you have the other logistical problem is, if he uses up his bottle of air, then does he have time to go run to the utility truck, or does the utility truck come to him, or what if the fire's not big enough to have a utility truck there? And
or so hasn't that, got there yet.
Yeah, it hasn't. Yeah, I mean,
or it's on the far side of the event
right,
from where you're located at, yeah.
So
yeah, there's definitely some considerations there. And it's, I think the thing is that we as a fire service need to collectively think about what we can do to implement best practice. So if best practice is that we're on an SCBA, then what are some things we can do to support that engineer to help them be in that position? Or most of the time, you have multiple engineers on one side of a fire, right? So those engineers will trade out bottles for each other and help each other. So you don't have to take your SCBA off necessarily, or you go off for a brief amount of time, then you go back on air. But whatever those details are that we work out, I think it's important that we, you know, what your story illustrates is that we have to start thinking about ways we can behave differently in order to take care of ourselves.
Well, and even if he had to go down to an air purifying respirator, because he is in outside air per se, so air purifying just filters the environment that you're in. And if you get a Seaburn canister that would filter out formaldehyde, the formaldehyde exposure where the engineer is probably is way less than what it is in the fire, because you don't have the walls around you and so forth. But it would, at the very least, get a HEPA filter, which will protect against the particulates. So it won't protect against the gases, but the particulate, which is mainly what's in the smoke.
Right. So you've got good, better, best, you know, with the SCBA being the number one thing. But it has some restrictions, weight on the body, needs to be refilled, et cetera, some stressors, et cetera. Heck, maybe we can come up with an SCBA for engineers that's a little bit more nimble and, an outside SCBA, if you will. I don't know. It's a weird thought that just came into my head. But, the degrees of protection is important. So speaking of that, I look at when our investigators come in and, it's always been a thought that they're fine, that, the fire has already cooled off, things have settled down. But from what I read, it sounds like when they come in and start turning things over and start scooping stuff up and manipulating the burned out fire, they're adding extra exposure. What's the word I'm looking for?
Well, they're
stirring it up.
Yeah, they're stirring it up. So if you look at, after the fire and you have the geometry of debris pile, so things landed wherever they landed and there's a geometry to that.
Okay.
And as the investigator is going through, they're disturbing that geometry. And in that geometry, just however things fall, again, there's pockets of air, pockets of toxic gas. So as they're rummaging through and moving things as a function of their investigation, they're releasing that pocket of gas. So in the study that I did with Willie Nelson, we started changing the media every 30 minutes.
So just to be clear, we're not talking about the singer. We're talking about one of our investigators.
Right.
Happens to share his name.
Right.
Okay, carry on.
So we changed the media every 30 minutes because we wanted to show as a function of time that the exposures are going down. So we were trying to delineate, how long after the fire is extinguished is it safe to go in. That was our objective. So is it in 1 hour, 2 hours? 3 days, what is it? And so we weren't expecting the result that we got. We were expecting it to continue to the concentrations to continue to go down as a function of time. So in the second 30 minutes or even the third 30 minutes, depending on the size of the fire and how long the investigator was there, we saw peaks where it was low in the first 30 minutes and then maybe sometimes double the second 30 minutes or the third. So now we're an hour and a half out from the time the investigator arrived, which it doesn't always align up with the time the fire was extinguished. There could be a break in between those times. So the fire is extinguished, then the investigator shows up however many minutes after the fire is extinguished or days. And then, so we saw these peaks and we're like, wow. And the only thing he was doing is his job.
Right.
And we saw another case in the original study. It was in the an expensive home that had a media room, and the fire started in the media room. So there's just, imagine a movie room in a, million-dollar estate with all the cushy chairs and everything. And the fire happened on 4th of July weekend in Phoenix, Arizona. And so the fire was extinguished, and they just boarded it up and then went back to sample 2 days later. And I thought it was a waste of time that we weren't going to get anything, and formaldehyde was still there in Phoenix, Arizona, when the ambient temperatures are pushing, 115 to 120 in July. But it was closed, it was boarded up, no ventilation, and the stuff just, so it was probably the materials in those cushy chairs and the carpeting and the stuff that burned. So
that makes sense. How does the heat correlate to what you're talking about as far as the...
I just thought it would burn off. I thought the heat, you know...
Cook it off, basically.
Cook it off, yeah. That's what I thought.
Right. But because it's contained, I mean, it's probably off-gassing, but it's all trapped inside there, so it doesn't get a chance to really ventilate away.
Right.
Interesting. It's... So investigators are, you know, typically more senior members of the organization. They're looking for an opportunity to do something a little bit different, maybe step down their career a little bit from, you know, run the medical calls and get off the fire truck a little bit and slow down, do some change pace. And yet their exposure is still significant.
Even on the front cover of my book, the picture that's there was one that Willie had taken at an investigation. And that was food on the stove.
Yeah, so it looks like a bunch of kitchen cabinets that are
put there. That was one of the highest formaldehyde levels that we had in the investigator study. And it was a nothing fire from a firefighter perspective. It was food on the stove, so the kitchen cabinets, you know, like big deal. It was an apartment, wasn't a big space, and very high.
Right. So you keep mentioning formaldehyde. And so what is that one of the more concerning gases?
It is for me because it does not have good warning properties to the human. So, and if I just give you some examples, like if there's acid gas at a fire, and you find that sometimes when plastics are burning and stuff, so if you take your mask off and your eyes start getting irritated immediately and maybe the inside of your nose starts getting tingly or itchy or a slight burning sensation, you're going to put your mask back on. No question, because it's uncomfortable to have it off.
Right.
Have you ever experienced something similar to that?
Yeah.
So that's acid gas. Acid gas has a very high exposure limit, but your human senses won't even allow you to reach that limit because of the irritation that happens. So ammonia is a good example, too.
It's got that early indication.
Right. So. Formaldehyde doesn't. And the ceiling value for formaldehyde is 0.1 parts per million. So 0.1. It's not even one part per million. It's 0.1 parts per million. So to give some perspective on what's a part per million, it's one penny in $10,000. It's not significant. And so 0.1 is one-tenth. It's one-tenth of a penny in $10,000. I mean, it's such a small volume. And it's so pervasive. It's in the OSB. It's in the carpet. It's in the laminates. It's in the foam. It's in everything. And I found it. That was the most pervasive thing I found in the overhaul study. And then when I did the study with Willie, which was, you know, 10, 15 years later, still, even those levels are climbing. They're not going away.
Right.
They're not going down as we get more modern furniture. They're going up. And they don't have good warning properties. So what's going to happen if you get overexposed to formaldehyde? You might have a little bit of a runny nose, but you're not going to be able to associate that with formaldehyde. And you're probably not going to have any irritation because the level's so low anyway. But it's a known human carcinogen. It attacks the upper respiratory system, your nose, throat, you know, this part of your respiratory. The other thing to consider is, you know, some of the solutions that we talk about in the book later is about deconning. And there's a lot of, there was a study that done by NIOSH to say to wipe off your skin with wipes. And so all these wipes have come out of the woodwork. There's all these new companies that sell firefighter wipes. Some of those wipes have formaldehyde in them. And the reason there's formaldehyde in them is because formaldehyde is used as a mold inhibitor. So they don't want you to pull the wipe out and have it be all moldy from sitting around, so they use formaldehyde as that agent to prevent mold growth. But now you're taking a formaldehyde-soaked towel, per se, and wiping off. It doesn't make any sense. So,
no, it doesn't make any sense. What are you looking for on labels? Is there a way to identify if there's what's in each product?
It would be listed on the label. You can ask for the SDS sheet on it or ask the manufacturer, is there any formaldehyde in it? They have to disclose that because it is formaldehyde is a carcinogen, so it has to be on the label.
And it's deliberately put into the product to preserve it.
It's in latex paint, even. Formaldehyde is used in latex paint as a mold inhibitor. So it's a very common use for formaldehyde. I don't think the people making them thought about it. You know, they just were thinking to keep the mold out of the product. But and I don't know if that's going to go, but I surely wouldn't put it on my neck if it had formaldehyde in it.
Right. It's not worth the risk.
But I think just regular baby wipes or a towel with soap and water is just as effective. Baby wipes aren't going to have formaldehyde in them.
Perfect. So baby wipes it is. So speaking of baby wipes, so we're talking about doing that kind of post-event decon. So you illustrate some work practices that are really simple and straightforward, and I'd love to kind of touch on each one of these briefly. I know that the first one made me laugh out loud, I got to say, because I'm like, this is not even possible. The first practice is, what do you got there?
I have a whole list of them.
Oh, nice. Cool. So you said sleep deprivation, get sleep. Okay, go ahead. Explain to me how this is even possible.
So I understand that how interrupted first responders' sleep patterns are, and even after they retire, they still have trouble. But 20-minute naps will give you 4 hours of alertness, and I think they've done sleep studies where, and the 20-minute nap isn't full REM sleep. It's like a yoga nap, so you're still aware of what's going on, but you're rested.
Power nap.
And people need to be trained on how to take a 20-minute nap, but it is very effective in buying you 4 hours of alertness, and I think we make better decisions when we're not sleep-deprived, and I think we're, as a nation, we are sleep-deprived. I mean, you have all your Fitbits and stuff, and they tell you how many hours of sleep. We're getting, on average, between 6 and 6.5 hours of sleep.
Right. So on the surface, I feel like it's intuitive that getting sleep is important, but why is that so important? When we talk about resisting exposure, What's the big health benefit?
Well, the health benefit is that's where all your healing happens, is when you're sleeping. So your cells start to repair themselves. And, I mean, sleep is a necessary part of health and safety.
No, and I know that. I just want to hear you say it out loud. Because I wanted the expert to say it. Because to me, we talk about how important sleep is, and yet we will stay up late binge watching television, we will play Xbox, we will, do these things that are fun, good recreation, etc., and we'll deprive ourselves because there's this idea out there that we're going to grind and hustle and we're going to do things and we're going to, 4 hours of sleep is sufficient, and I'm an animal if I can get by with only 4 hours of sleep. But at the end of the day, we are truly harming ourselves by not allowing ourselves to get proper amounts of sleep, what the body requires.
And I just wonder how many other ancillary things are connected to that, like guys getting in car accidents on the way home from their shift,
sure.
The vehicle accidents that happen with the fire apparatus, are those related to sleep deprivation? And
right.
Just your decisions you make on scene, whether to mask up or not.
Right.
I think it's all tied, because when you're tired, you don't care. And Las Vegas has it figured out. They keep you up all night and feed you alcohol, and you get to the point where you're gambling, where you don't care. You just want to, you want to go to bed, but you're making bad decisions. You're not.
Right.
And that's how they keep the lights on there.
Right. Well, it's interesting is there's a Mayday study done by Don Abbott who. It says that I'm going to misquote the data here, so I'm not going to speak to it, but the majority of Maydays are called on the second half of the shift on 24s, and people who are working 48, 96s on the second half of the 48s is when they're having the majority of their Maydays. So that speaks directly to this idea of fatigue and sleep deprivation, and it's a compounding factor. If you're not getting consistent good sleep, you are consistently deprived your immune system is depressed, and you have this general sense of fatigue about you that you can't quite recover from. And so you're just kind of zombie through life.
Right.
And
you're more vulnerable to cancers and other things too. So
right. So that's the huge part about it. So the next thing you talk about is eating right and hydration, et cetera. So what are some of the benefits of good nutrition? I feel like from a general fitness and health perspective, it's kind of obvious, but we're talking about mitigating the exposures.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it's building your immune system too. And I think that the municipal fire departments have this, you know, a good handle on this. You don't see a lot of overweight guys on the job here in Phoenix, for, you know, generally speaking. But when you go to West Virginia or some of the counties and, you know, the middle of nowhere, the first responders are showing up at 350 pounds. And I just think that a lot of them are volunteers. They're eating fast food, working in between jobs, and not paying attention to any of that. And right. So, and you look at the cardiac deaths and stuff, those are happening more with the volunteers, I think, than the career firefighters that are paid by municipalities. So these work practices, I was really mindful in selecting them, and I didn't look at any of the others that are published. I know that there's one in New York that's the New York 15, or there's another one that's 13 things to do, and I intentionally didn't look at any of that because my objective was that these work practices could be implemented by even the poorest volunteer fire department with no additional cost to their budget. And so that's why I was mindful of that. But eating right is, I mean, you eat a heavy meal, you know, you don't sleep right if you eat a lot of fat, and there's been plenty of studies on that with the fire service in general, and a lot of things where even fire departments have gone to plant-based diets and cleaned up their health. And if you read the news now, that's where everybody's talking about plant-based diet and how much healthier it is, and farm to table. The closer you are to the farm, you know, to the source, the healthier the food is, the more processed it is, the worse it is for you. And I mean, you look at even the disease we have in this country, a lot of it's tied right to nutrition. Right. There's foods that promote inflammation. There are foods that fight inflammation. So there's a quote in the book that I really liked, and it was about everything you put in your mouth is either fighting disease or promoting it.
Mm. That's a good point. I think it's one of those things that we all know how important it is. You've heard about it enough. You've read about it. And I don't care what diet you do. If you're eating whole foods, you're in a better place. It takes being proactive and thoughtful and engaged in your life. Like, if you just like, I'm going to passively go through my life, suddenly I'm hungry. Oh, that wasn't predictable. So now, oh my gosh, I need to eat something. I need to eat some food. What is it going to be? Well, I'm going to grab what's close because I'm on the go and I don't have time. And this is a real problem for all of us because we pack our lives with so much stuff. We're so busy, 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 and we don't allow ourselves time for, you know, self-maintenance and for eating properly. To me, that's part of that self-maintenance piece, is looking out for your own best interest. So that's huge.
And food is medicine at the end of the day. I mean, yeah. Really.
Yeah. There was a book I read back in the day, The Zone by Dr. Barry Sears. And he talks about, and this is kind of going on a tangent here, but he talks about carbohydrates and specifically how whenever you eat a carbohydrate, you have an insulin response. And so it is a drug. You are causing a hormonal response in your body when you eat food. So think about what you're eating, because it causes changes in your body. So good, bad, otherwise, you got to be paying attention to that. And, you know, I'm not saying step away from the enchiladas, but I'm saying eat them less frequently. So the annual physical, I think, is a huge, huge benefit for us. And, you know, organizationally in the city of Phoenix, it's something that we do here very well, right? We have a health center set up, et cetera. The pathway, I was talking to a friend of mine who does not work for us, who has a private sector job, and he hasn't had a physical in 20 years. And I'm like, you know, my conversation with him is, hey, man, this is something that you have to do. You've got to be going and getting checked out. And you know, going in and having conversations about how your body's changing over the years, getting exams, some that are less favorable than others, but getting those exams done, it's important to your health, and it can find things early on before they get out of control, and that's so important.
Well, the other thing is to pay attention in your departments to how you're tracking that, because when I worked for Phoenix, I was I chased everybody down to make sure they got their fit test and their physical, but I was more focused on the fit test. But in doing the fit test tracking, I discovered that people had missed their physical, and you're like, how could that happen? And what happens is, and I don't know if this is still like this, but at the time, people would make their appointment to do their physical, and then something would come up and they'd reschedule it, or they wouldn't show up. And the fact that they made the appointment checked the box.
Oh, interesting.
And so then they could theoretically miss for several years without anybody kind of tracking that.
Right.
And that was, at the time, I think we were using manual tracking systems, so maybe that's been resolved. Same thing with the fit test. That wasn't, you weren't pulled off the truck if you didn't have a fit test. So this is when Brunicini was here, and I ran into him in the parking lot, and I was on my mission to get every single firefighter fit tested. And none of his kids had gone in for a fit test. So I asked him, I said, Chief, can you get your kids in to get their fit test done? And he said, well, maybe you ought to talk to their mom because they don't listen to me. And I said, there's 200 people on that list. And then I had his attention. So he's like, how can I know this? And how is this happening? But it wasn't regarded as, and the reason why fit testing is so important, because you think, why do I need to be fit tested? I'm on positive pressure. If there's a leak, the leak's going out. Like, who cares? The thing is that you're going to dump your bottle faster. So if you have a big leak, your air is going to go faster than you think it should, or than you expect it should. So if you want to stay in longer, make sure you have a tight seal. And then also, if you end up putting in canister cartridges or something to protect yourself at a lower level, that fit isn't right for that, too.
Isn't there that little thing with OSHA mandated as well?
It is OSHA mandated.
Yeah, so that's a tricky thing. You know, organizations, you know, the management of this stuff is challenging because you have human beings who are involved, and sometimes human beings decide to cancel an appointment, and they may care less than you do about their safety, which is kind of why this conversation is so important, because we need to bring it to the forefront how important this is and how much you, the listener, should care about your own longevity and your own health and safety throughout the course of this. If, you know, if the organization cares more about you than you care about you, that's a problem.
Right. Well, in some organizations, I mean, I think that year where I was on my mission to get everybody fit tested, that organizations don't have the bandwidth sometimes to look and see who they missed because they're so busy serving the ones that are showing up. So I think it's just another way to look at it. It sounds so obvious. Like, of course we get our annual physicals and fit tests. Of course we do, you know, but not if, and also if you're on the edge of being pulled out of the field for a health issue, you may be sidestepping this intentionally too. So there are other reasons. Right. You know, guys don't want to be pulled off for fitness for duty. And so if they've got a health issue that they think is going to, you know, take their firefighter card away, and as far as working in the field, they might be sidestepping this intentionally. Right. And that's just a hazard to them and their whole crew too.
Exactly. They're just creating more risk for themselves. So take care of yourself, man. Go get your physical. So you talk about a couple things you go down. You talk about, you say always wear your PPE. Before I go there, you talked about treat all fires as a hazmat incident. Give me the big chunks on that. What do you mean by that?
So if you look at your hazmat team, you know, internally here, they're not rushing in. You know, they're making a plan, and you would never see a hazmat guy without their gloves on, or without their mask on, or without their regulator clicked in. It's a different approach. And you don't see a lot of injuries with hazmat teams, generally speaking, because they're running at a slower pace and they're more methodical in their approach. But you can turn on any news channel and look at social media, look at videos that fire departments are putting out to train their members, and they're not wearing their stuff. So the training is great training, but I can't even pay attention to the training because I'm like, how could they be doing this without any of their stuff on? You know, seriously.
Right.
And even on the news media, you don't have to look too hard or too far. And I've been in travel to multiple cities and I'm just like, oh my God, there's a shot from the newscast and there's the full array of the full rainbow of how many people are compliant with the prescribed PPE and how many are in that same environment with little or no PPE on.
Right.
Or extinguishing a car fire with your regulator hanging down and you're in full turnouts. It just makes no sense to me. So car fires are probably the most acutely hazardous because of all, I mean, cars aren't made out of metal anymore. And the engine and everything is all full of plastic. So when I was working as an industrial hygienist with the city of Phoenix, I was reviewing an industrial case where a firefighter got glass in their eye from an exploding headlight. And so I'm like, well, how could they get glass in their eye if they had their, and then I was like, oh, they didn't have their face piece on. So there was one published on social media not that long ago that was, one of my firefighter friends posted something on Facebook. It said, Carbecue, 5 o'clock on Friday, happy Friday or something. And there was a young firefighter putting out the fire with his regulator hanging down. Yeah. And I'm like, how can this still be happening today?
Right. Yeah, good question. We know enough to know better, but yet sometimes we make, I mean, sometimes there's simple contextual errors, right? We don't know exactly what happened. So there's errors that take place, but man, we got to be better about that. We can't. I think you talk, the idea you mentioned about hazmat being this idea that we are slowing down to make sure we're checking the boxes, so to speak. We're going through a kind of a pre-flight checklist to make sure our pieces are in place before we expose ourselves is really important.
Right.
There's, there's some chatter in the American Fire Service that, you know, the, speed is what saves lives. And that, you know, you worrying about yourself, you worrying about cancer is not honoring your mission. But I would submit to you that being prepared, and actually I think you speak about this specifically, but showing up ready to go with your PPE in place and then making sure you check your boxes, so to speak, you know, your regulator's in place, your mask is on, you've been fit tested, you've had your annual physical, you're doing those things preparatory to the fight. You are much more effective as a firefighter and much more effective in your ability to conduct a rescue or to rapidly extinguish a fire and stop the spread, et cetera. But you have to have those things in place first. Otherwise, you're long term, you can't fulfill the mission if you're dying of cancer.
Right.
That doesn't serve anybody well at the end of the day if you're sick.
The other thing to consider is, you know, like you talked about early, how the dynamics of fire suppression are changing because the contents are changing. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if you've seen the video that Underwriters Lab put out, but it's on YouTube where they have the modern furniture furnished.
The legacy furniture versus the modern.
Yeah. And how it gets to flash over in like 3 minutes in the modern and it takes 30 minutes for the legacy.
Yeah.
So fires today... And also the open floor plan that everybody enjoys just makes that fire, you know, burn faster and hotter and whatever, and people don't keep their doors closed in their house. So the reality is that when you are using, so if speed is your reason why you couldn't get all dressed out because you want to save these people's lives, the reality is they're probably long gone before you even get the call. You know, with the contents of the homes, the construction of the homes, with this open floor plan, the idea that it's going to flash over in 3 minutes, you can't even get there in 3 minutes, and now the gas is already on fire in the house, and those people are severely injured if they're even and probably would rather be, you know, dead than to go through burn treatments.
Well, and to your point, the majority of fire fatalities are smoke inhalation. So we reach, you know, we reach flashover temperatures super fast. The entire compartment is saturated with toxic gases long before you ever get there. Now, that doesn't mean there's not survivable space. However, understand the context of the operation and understand that you are not helping anybody if you're not fully dressed out.
Right.
You know, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's it, the fire dynamics have to be taken into consideration when you're talking about PPE and the way in which you're doing this job. Not to mention, if you don't have your full PPE on, you go running in there and it reflashes when you introduce oxygen into the space. And, you know, those are elements that you need to take into consideration as well.
And you forgot your hood or you forgot a glove or...
Right. Yeah, because you're in too much of a hurry, right? So that, you know, you talk about preparation being, you know, not only, to me, preparation isn't just the things you do ahead of time when it comes to setting up your equipment, getting, you know, tested, making fit tested, et cetera, but it's also training, having the skills to move smoothly and effectively and quickly. And that's a, you know, that's a whole conversation, but that's part of that is the preparation for the execution of your skill set. To me, that's where professionalism lies, is checking these boxes and having your pre-flight done, and for lack of a better expression, and then having the knowledge, skills, and abilities well honed and well tuned in, so that you're actually able to affect your skills, affect the job appropriately.
Right.
So we talked. You know, we're talking about wearing PPE, wearing respiratory protection, and we've covered that a little bit, I think. And the thing I want to jump to is decon. So we see a lot of people doing, you know, gross decon now, and it's something that is probably growing in its acceptance, I think. But what does that look like to you?
So gross decon is just, you know, hosing each other down on scene and knocking off the big stuff. As far as wiping your skin, I'm for that. I don't know that departments need to spend $40,000 a year on specific wipes. I think a towel and soap and water is just as effective, or a rag, something you can wash and be environmentally friendly too, instead of generate all this waste. So it's just deconning on scene. Now, that sounds simple too, but how do you do that on the side of the freeway after a car fire? So I think you have to be realistic in the application, because if you're going to cause your members harm where cars are whizzing by at 75 miles an hour, it's probably not a good idea to spend any more time on that side of the road than you need to. But as soon as you get back to the station, or if you're a volunteer and you're going home, you know, be mindful of how you're entering your station, how you're entering your home, where if you can start stripping down. I mean, they even say that if you're exposed to bed bugs, like drop your uniforms in the bay and run in naked into the station and shower, so you don't track all that stuff in. And it's the same kind of idea. So it's not bringing that into your living space. So if you have I've responded to indoor air quality complaints in fire stations where the guys had a remnant piece of carpeting in their little dorm room, and I told them to get the carpet out of there, because that's just a giant sponge for everything that they're picking up on scene and then carrying with their shoes or their brush pants or whatever, and bringing it back into the space that they're sleeping in. As soon as we got rid of the carpet, the air quality went away. So if you want throw rugs and stuff that you can put in the washing machine and wash regularly. If you have curtains that separate your dorm spaces, those should be washed periodically. Kind of look at it as like a hotel. How often do you wash sheets? How often do you wash your bedding? All that stuff plays into decon. So what are you taking in your vehicle home with you? If you're a rover, where are you storing your turnouts? Are they next to your groceries? Are they next to your kids' sporting equipment? All that stuff is just being it's looking at it through a different set of lenses.
Yeah. When I was roving, I had a little Jeep Cherokee, and we had a nice fire. And at the end of the day, I took my stuff and threw it in the back of my Jeep. Went home. You know, I could smell it back there, but it didn't think much about it. Well, I parked my Jeep, And then I forgot my gear in the truck, and I didn't touch my truck for 48 hours. And I go out and get in it, and the smell nearly knocked me out of the vehicle because it was so gross. Not only was it the smell of fire, but the smell of like mildew that was building up in my wet gear sitting in there. I'm like, oh, that was a huge mistake. So I went out and bought a rocket box and put it on top of my vehicle, and then my gear would get thrown up there. Even then, I wasn't laundering it the way I should have been. And so that's something that, for me now, every fire, the gear goes down and gets cleaned, and it goes through the extractor. So here's a question for you, though. Is there any data that speaks to how clean gear is even after it's been through an extractor?
The only data that I know, and it's not published, is some work that Tim Derby did when he was over at Fire Resource. And he took swatches of different turnouts and washed it in different detergents and then sent it off to a lab to see how clean is clean.
Oh, okay.
And what he found was Purex did the best job out of all the name brand. I mean, Purex wasn't even, I don't even know if they still make it, but it was like kind of that low-end laundry detergent. It wasn't one of the top brands, and he compared it to the top brands, and Purex did the best. I don't know that there's any published study on there, but I do have a product mentioned in the back of my book called Microblaze, which has been used to clean turnouts, and it actually has microbes in it that digest the carbon, and it's an environmentally friendly cleaner, degreaser, whatever, and you can put it in as laundry detergent and use it.
Well, the part of what concerns me is not only guys and gals are sending their stuff off to be cleaned, and they get their clean gear back, and they go off and they do skills courses and exercise and workouts with their gear on, or even training with their gear on, and they're thinking, well, I'm good. My gear's totally clean now, and I'm good until my next fire, so to speak, to wear my equipment. And, they're getting hot. They're opening up those pores. They're kind of opening up the pathways for exposure. And so the question is, are they needlessly exposing themselves, or are they good to go?
I don't know that.
Kind of a big question.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that you could, we don't live in plastic bubbles, so I think if they had it cleaned and then they're doing non-fire related activities in it, I would think it would be okay. Of course, they're going to sweat and for the most part, most of that stuff's going to be taken off, the bulk of it, I guess.
Right. But,
NASA did a study. They were doing some training burns and looking at particulate, so for space stations and other whatever they do. And they had some real-time detection equipment on while they were doing this, looking at particle counting and stuff. And so they went on lunch break, and somebody forgot to turn the meters off, and they hung their turnouts in this room. And they could visually see through their metering devices that the turnouts were losing mass. It was like raining particulates for the whole time they were at lunch, and they were like, holy crap, like we had no idea. And so they didn't publish that data, but they, are just like, wow, that was something unexpected. And it was so I think for the most part, the things that, the extractors and stuff are going to get the particulates off. I don't know about, what gets embedded in the fibers of turnouts, and you can see even after they're clean that they're not, don't look brand spanking new.
They slowly change color over the years.
So there's some absorption going on in there, but I don't know, without taking swatches and actually identifying what's there. Right. I mean, that could be
I got your next project.
Yeah, it could be another project. But I would like to go back to the respirator just for a minute before we move on, because this is one of my soapboxes. And the soapbox is that I see guys wearing N95 respirators in overhaul. And so those N95 respirators are put on fire vehicles for tuberculosis years ago. And so they were put there for medical calls. So if somebody's hacking a lung up in the ambulance, you can put a mask on the patient, or you can put a mask on yourself to protect yourself from those biological health hazards.
Basically.
And so the guys, and I've seen it on the news and I've seen it in person, that they're passing these out like candy. So drop our SCBA, but there still might be something here, so it's better to put this on. And the reason why I'm so passionate about it is because I believe the people are putting it on because they believe there's a hazard there. But what they're putting on is not going to protect them from the most pervasive thing that's there, and that's the formaldehyde. So the formaldehyde is going to go right through that like they're not even wearing it.
Right.
Those masks, when I do training on it, I say those masks will protect you from chipping a tooth if a rock is flying by. And that's about it. I mean, those are particulate masks. The fit is
just
very
dust,
poor.
Basically dust.
Yeah, I mean, you see people mowing their lawn with them, and even then, I mean, your protection factor is between 5 and 10. So what that means is your concentration inside your mask is either 5 or 10 times lighter or less concentrated than the concentration outside your mask, which is
nothing.
I mean, you'd be better off putting a bandana on because the bandana would even have a tighter fit than that mask, because you can put a finger through. I mean, they're not tight fitting.
Right.
And they're designed for particulate, or they're really designed for medical reasons. And so when fire departments are passing them out to homeowners and their guys, you know, to run through an overhaul or to the investigator, I think just the education. So if they have the education and they want to use that anyway, then there's nothing I can do. But my perception is that they don't have the education to know that mask isn't protecting them against anything that they're worried about. And they should be worried about what's in overhaul because of the plastic load we all have in our homes today. And the particulates are pretty much clear anyway because the environment's very wet. So it's the gas that you have to worry about. And it's the gas that you can't detect with the human senses, like formaldehyde.
Right.
And so if the acid gas was all over, you wouldn't wear that mask. You'd put your SCBA back on because you'd have irritation. So that's kind of my message. And I talk about it in the book, but under no circumstances should wear an N95 or those paper masks with the two straps on a fire scene ever, like
right.
ever. If I could get that message out, that would be success for me, if that's all people got out of the book.
Good. Well, you know what? That's a great place to stop right there then, because that's the high water mark. Wear your SCBA, dummy.
Now you know. Why would you go with anything less?
Now you know. Well, I think, yeah, so it's really, I think there's some learning that has to happen, and we're all growing and figuring this out, and understanding the true impact. It really helps. You know, when you look at the line of duty deaths, we are all beginning to know people now who are dying from cancer, work-related, job-related cancers, and now that we know that, we can really anchor this on human beings that we've known. So hopefully that'll help catalyze some change for us and help reinforce how important this it is that we protect ourselves from exposure. So Dawn,
yeah.
I really appreciate you taking the time and sitting with me and talking through this. You know, I read your book and I feel like I understood it, but it helped me to have this conversation with you. It really helped me understand it at another level. And so I want everyone to go out and get this book, get a copy of it. And where can they find this book?
So right now it's just on my website. It's DawnBolsteadJohnson.com.
How do you spell it?
So D-A-W-N and then B as in boy, O-L-S-T-A-D and then Johnson. So it's all run together. Dawn Bolstead Johnson, common spelling, JOHNSON.com. And I'm donating 25% of the proceeds of the book back to firefighter-related cancer charities. And so I looked at putting it on Amazon as a way to get it out there. And Amazon takes 60% of the list price, which is basically how much it costs to print the book. So then I couldn't donate to any charity, and so that's why I have it. That's why I decided to just put it on my website.
Okay.
I've shipped copies. I just shipped one out to Canada this morning. Somebody ordered a book this morning and to Canada, but I've shipped to Australia, Canada, England. Somebody took a picture of my book on the beach in Dubai and said, "Great read." But what I would really like too is to get this book in the classrooms for the new recruits. For their new recruits to read it ahead before they enter into the fire service. So yeah. Across the country, I mean, and people who have read the book have even said that this needs to be in the hands of every recruit. And the spouses should read it too, so they can understand and have an eye out for how their spouse, you know, how their husbands are coming home or how their wives are coming home and their work practices with entering the home and with their gear and whatever, especially if they're having young families.
If somebody has some specific questions for you or some research ideas or what have you, wants to have you come out and speak or something like that, is there a best way to contact you or through your website?
Yeah, through the website. There's the way to contact me through there. And I've got my, do you want me to give you my email or?
Whatever works best for you, yeah.
So my email is dbolstead@kaizensafetysolutions.com. And that's Kaizen is K-A-I-Z-E-N, safetysolutions.com. And Kaizen is Japanese for continuous improvement. So just small incremental steps. So it's not, you know, all of these things are very simple, but they're not always easy to implement. But if you start paying attention to them, you can see how the chain of events can change and the attitudes can change. And just simple things like not wearing N95 masks and overhaul can be huge for exposure perspective. Yeah. Just that one small change. So there's a lot more work to be done as far as shifting the culture and the perceptions of exposure, because, you know, you're asking people to protect against something that they're not having health effects for. And that's a really hard nut to crack.
Absolutely. Well, Dawn, thank you for taking a stab at it. And because I think that these little pieces will help us get there. So thank you so much for sitting down with me. And I will link a link to your book, to your website, in the show notes. I'm still getting my hands wrapped around how to do all this stuff, but I promise you it'll be there somehow, some way. We'll link it. And so go out and get yourself a copy of this book and enjoy it. It's a good read. Make some changes in your life and protect yourself.